The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. So I'm really excited to be here today to be talking about immigrant rights in this political moment. And I'm especially inspired by the hundreds of thousands of people who have taken to the streets over the past few weeks to protest the constant attack on immigrant rights that we've been facing. So both in this country and internationally. The number of displaced people worldwide is at a record high of 65.5 million and growing. Less than 1% of those people are being resettled each year. On average, there are anywhere between 300 and 450,000 immigrants being held in detention centers in the United States at any given time, which is more than anywhere else in the world. Last month, the media exploded with stories of immigrant children being separated from their families and being held in cages in detention centers near the U.S.-Mexico border. While this is not a new phenomenon, the media attention created by leaked photos and recordings of children crying for their parents created public outcry and pressure on the administration to change these violent and inhumane practices. As a result of all the bad press, on June 20th, Trump signed an executive order to stop separating children from their families at the border. While this will alleviate a small amount of the cruelty upon which U.S. immigration policy operates, it is in no way a solution to the violence that immigrants face in this country as part of a racist immigration system. The executive order halts family separation, which was a practice that had originally been absolved but was reinstated by the Obama administration in 2014. What this means is that instead of incarcerating children separately from their parents, innocent families will be incarcerated together in detention centers that resemble prisons and concentration camps, with some being held in actual federal and local prisons. The government is currently spending billions of taxpayer dollars to construct detention facilities that can accommodate entire families. The term being used by policymakers in the media to describe what immigrants are experiencing in this country is detention. However, the reality is that they are being incarcerated. Detention centers and the detention of innocent families is part of the prison industrial complex in the way that the infrastructure to incarcerate black and brown bodies already exists on a massive scale in this country. And the technology, law enforcement, and spaces that are used to incarcerate people who commit crimes are the same as those being used against immigrants. Not only does ICE operate as law enforcement agency with an enormous budget of $5.2 million, but immigrants are being held in county jails, federal and private prisons, and by independent companies who are profiting off of their incarceration. Nonprofits across the country have also been contracted hundreds of millions of dollars in 2018 alone to aid in incarcerating immigrant children. An investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting found that over the past 4 years, $3.4 billion federal dollars went to foster homes and organizations with serious allegations of mistreating children. Recent reports have found that sexual assault of both minors and adults is incredibly common in detention centers. There have even been multiple findings of children and adult migrants being drugged without consent. It is worth noting that it is illegal under human rights law to detain children for immigration purposes. While the executive order claims that children will no longer be separated from their families, it does not account for the 2,300 children who have already been separated from their parents. These children have been shipped to detention facilities and foster homes all over the country, and there was never a plan in place to reunite separated families throughout this process, meaning that for many of these families, reunification will be impossible. Volunteer lawyers and reporters who have traveled to the border to try and aid immigrant families have found themselves with the near impossible task of finding and tracking down children and parents. For many of these families, the damage will be irreparable. Many volunteer lawyers have commented on the absurdity of the situation, being clear while trying to hold Know Your Rights classes for children by drawing stick figures, and children being expected to represent themselves in court when they are too young to even know what a lawyer is. Adults do not have a much higher likelihood of their cases going well in court. Most asylum seekers do not have access to a lawyer, and those who do often only have 5 minutes with their lawyer before their hearing. It has also become common practice to hold mass immigration trials, sometimes with up to 100 people being tried at the same time. Trump's zero tolerance policy means that those who cross the border are charged with a criminal violation as opposed to a civil violation for entering the country. This means that the government can consider all immigrants as criminals and use this against them in court. Many people entering the United States are refugees who intend on applying for asylum, which is only possible to do so from within the United States. The legal way to apply for asylum is to enter the country at a port of entry and apply upon arrival. From there, asylum seekers will have a credible fear interview before appearing before an immigration judge. Under the current administration, it has become common practice to turn asylum seekers away from ports of entry, which is illegal under both international and domestic law. Another tactic being used is coercing asylum seekers into signing voluntary deportation documents. The administration is attempting to deport people before they can tell their stories, because if they have well-founded reason to fear for their lives, they are legally considered refugees and cannot be sent back. If they are unable to tell their stories, they can be more easily deported. The only option that asylum seekers have left once turned away from ports of entry at the border is to cross the river, which has resulted in many migrant deaths, or to pay smugglers to help them get across, which not all migrants can afford and which leaves them at risk of trafficking. For those who are able to apply for asylum in the United States, the asylum process takes so long that by the time the asylum case has been processed and decided, they have overstayed their visa, which means that they can be deported just on that basis alone. This silences activists who want to speak out against the unjust immigration system because the state can hold this against them, and it makes it incredibly difficult to build and sustain movements to fight for better conditions in the immigration system. Refugees and asylum seekers generally already have high levels of trauma caused by the situations they are fleeing in their home countries. The experience of being a refugee and going through the asylum process is often traumatizing in and of itself. In the United States and across much of Europe, immigrants find themselves incarcerated indefinitely, waiting for incompetent asylum systems to determine their future or if they will have a future at all. They are generally unable to work legally, which leaves them subject to high levels of exploitation without agency in their circumstances. The trauma from their past, combined with the trauma of inhumane living conditions while they await their decision, on top of living without control of their future, can lead to a variety of mental health issues, including depression and suicidal thoughts. At the same time, there is very little access to mental health resources for refugees and asylum seekers. An Eritrean asylum seeker was recently deported from the United States, and though he claimed that his life would be in danger if he was returned home, he then committed suicide at the Cairo airport. There have also been several instances of suicide in detention centers and refugee camps. The Department of Homeland Security is the federal department responsible for handling immigration and border patrol. The fact that in the United States, immigration is viewed as a security issue speaks volumes to the ways in which it is handled and discussed in mainstream discourse and enables rhetoric, such as that used by the Trump administration of immigrants as criminals, to influence the immigration policy and the treatment of immigrants in this country. The asylum interview is framed around trying to prove fraud or inconsistencies in the asylum seeker's story, rather than offering a supportive framework for those seeking safety. DHS lawyers often use the same arguments against political asylum seekers that were used against them by governments in their home countries that caused them to seek asylum in the first place, which effectively works to support repressive regimes. In the time between 2005 and 2014, an estimated 40,000 people died while trying to cross a border. In 2018 alone, over 1,000 people have drowned in the Mediterranean attempting to cross to Europe. As right-wing governments gain power in the United States and Europe, these numbers continue to rise as violent border patrol policies are enforced on refugees and people looking for a better life. Today, borders are often perceived as a natural part of our world. However, they are not. Borders are a relatively recent colonial institution. Colonialism is the violent occupation of land in order to exploit its labor and resources. European colonial powers drew up borders across the world to divide stolen land amongst themselves. Often borders were constructed with the intent to divide communities in order to weaken colonized people from organizing and revolting, like in much of Africa. Other times, border lines were drawn simply according to what was most convenient for the colonizers. For example, the border between Iraq and Syria is just a straight line to divide up French and British territory. While borders are not natural, and therefore not stagnant, the majority of the world maintains its colonial borders today. These human-drawn lines are still a major source of conflict and violence. Physical borders emerged with capitalism in order to protect private property, and in the process led to a creation of identities and an establishment of social relations. Historically, walls and policing of territories has existed to protect from invading armies. However, today it exists to keep out migrants in search of a better quality of life. Under capitalism, borders function as a way to control labor, as a way to keep wages unlivable in order to maximize profits, and to be able to hold the threat of deportation over the heads of any worker who tries to organize for better working conditions. Immigration policy in the United States has historically been shaped around weakening the labor movement and to institutionalize discrimination against immigrants, whether it be racial, national, or political. The existence of nations and borders allows for the barring of political participation from immigrants through the distinctions of documented and undocumented, and therefore robs the immigrants of their political agency within the state system. Through social movements and organizing, immigrants actually hold a lot of power as workers who are integral to the functioning of our society. However, the distinction of documented and undocumented immigrant translates to legal versus illegal immigrant, and these statuses serve as an effective tool of keeping undocumented immigrant communities quiet in fear of deportation. As socialists, we believe that no human being is illegal, and that every person deserves human rights, livable working conditions, and the right to organize and self-determination, regardless of how they arrived in the country they are living in. To accomplish this, we fight for a world without borders. In order to talk about migration, it is necessary to understand the reasons why people migrate, and to understand that often people do not have a choice. While violence still exists in places due to the effects of colonialism and ignorant land divisions, such as in Palestine and Israel, a major cause of migration today is effects of imperialism and neoliberal policies. Imperialism is the continuation of colonial practices in using neoliberal policies and institutions to exploit labor and resources. Imperialism is achieved through political destabilization, military intervention, and proxy wars, all of which are violent and make it difficult for people to survive. Imperialism also uproots local economies, replacing them with capitalism, and creates a dependency on international capitalism. Often, economic hardship is perceived as an illegitimate cause for migration. However, under capitalism, economic stability is necessary in order to survive. And therefore, the inability to survive economically is clearly a legitimate cause for migration and should be granted the same justification that is given to those migrating to escape violence or any other reason for that matter. Those escaping war and political violence are sometimes granted the legal rights that come with the classification of refugee or asylum seeker, while those who are victims of institutionalized violence are labeled migrant and do not have the same rights or legal protections. The classification of refugee was defined in the United States after World War II, so the qualifications are specific to those fleeing violence from war. Because of this, it is often difficult for refugees fleeing for reasons other than internationally recognized war, such as gang violence or domestic violence, to prove a need for refugee status, especially given the lack of access to lawyers and legal services in the asylum process. For those fleeing gang-related violence, it is very dangerous for them to claim asylum on this basis, because if their case is rejected and they are deported, it is essentially a death sentence in their home countries. However, without a lawyer, the likelihood of deportation is high. Even though many of the people immigrating to the United States are fleeing their home countries as victims of gang violence and sexual violence, the Trump administration still perpetuates stereotypes of immigrants as gang members and rapists to justify its violent zero-tolerance immigration policies. Though the administration has used the trope of good immigrant, bad immigrant, by using immigrants with criminal backgrounds to rationalize immigration policies, we reject the notion that only people with no criminal background deserve safety and opportunity for a better life in this country, and we demand amnesty for all. In the way that cartels have been the boogeyman fueling Trump's hateful immigration policies around the U.S.-Mexican border, ISIS and other extremist religious groups in the Middle East have served the same purpose in the administration's implementation of the Muslim ban. In 2017, over 1,400 Syrian civilians were killed at the hands of ISIS and other extremist groups, exemplifying that though the West has fueled its racist immigration policies with Islamophobia, it is actually Muslims and civilians from the banned countries who are the overwhelming majority of victims of religious extremism in the region. Not only does this work to the advantage of the administration in enforcing xenophobic immigration policies, but it also works to the advantage of regimes like Bashar al-Assad's in reframing the conflict and shifting the blame to the over 4,100 civilians murdered by the regime forces in 2017 to groups like ISIS in an attempt to justify genocide by the regime. In 2018, the United States has accepted a total of 11 refugees from Syria. The United States has resettled 29 refugees from Iraq, a country destabilized directly by American imperialism. From both of these countries, refugee resettlement in the United States has decreased by 98% this year under the Trump administration. Even those who are forced to flee their home countries due to political persecution for aiding the U.S. military in its imperial endeavors have little claim to asylum in this country and can be found stranded in refugee camps and detention centers across the globe. Following 9/11, the U.S. has masked its imperialist endeavors with a war on terror. The U.S.-Mexican border has felt this effect through a Bush-initiated and Obama-followed multi-billion-dollar border wall project, no doubt paving the way for Trump's inane obsession with the wall. The war on terror was constructed to gain public consent for imperialist endeavors in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, the media's acceptance of this narrative has also created the circumstances for Trump's travel ban to be implemented. Post 9/11, anti-immigration laws that target Arabs and Muslims normalize the targeting of immigrants and are now hegemonically used against all immigrants. While war is a clear example of violence that displaces people, there are other violent methods used under capitalism to displace people from their homelands. However, due to the institutionalization of these types of violence, it is often less common for people to recognize their legitimacy. Under capitalism, financial stability is necessary in order for survival. Imperialism is the practice of exploiting labor and resources in other countries for profit. And this makes it incredibly difficult for many people in these countries to obtain financial stability and have a good quality of life, or even to survive at all. The lack of jobs, or even the dependence on jobs that create profit, are a result of Western imperialism. However, when the victims of these systems attempt to migrate to Western countries in search of access to jobs and livable working conditions, they are accused of being job-stealing immigrants, when in reality, they were the ones who were robbed of jobs and opportunity in the first place. However, this stereotype is perpetuated by the right in generating anti-immigrant sentiment so they can continue to deprive immigrants of rights and citizenship and therefore keep them highly exploitable and unable to organize. This tactic is effective in dividing the working class in that it redirects the blame from the capitalists who give jobs to those who are most easily exploited, and this division prevents the working class, citizen and non-citizen, from organizing together for better working conditions and jobs for all. The response to the media coverage of a child abuse in detention centers has been very significant. Although the executive order to stop family separation is not the victory we need, mass movement has forced Trump to go back on his word after claiming that he had no power to sign an executive order to stop family separations, and using it as a tactic to blackmail Democrats into funding a border wall. Several mass protests have been called in response to the cruel and racist immigration policies being put forth by the administration. Though many of these policies existed before Trump took office, they have come to the attention of the mainstream media through mass movements to resist Trump. Protests such as the Families Belong Together demonstrations have been hugely successful in that hundreds of thousands have turned out across the country to show solidarity with immigrants. Many of the mass actions have been called by liberal organizations and have had demands like voting out the racist right and electing Democrats into office. However, more radical and effective demands such as abolish ICE have made their way into mainstream discourse and had a strong presence at these demonstrations. The attacks on DACA by the Trump administration has also led to a movement of visibility of undocumented migrants, showing how integrated and necessary they are in our communities and society, creating a space for immigration issues in the mainstream media. With election season approaching, much of this pro-immigration energy will likely turn to getting Democrats elected as means to improve immigration policy. Though this rhetoric around election season is pro-immigration, pro-refugee, this is not at all the reality of policies enacted by Democrats. Obama ran his election campaign on the tail of the 2006 immigrants' rights movement, using rhetoric from the movement to promise for a fight for immigrant rights. In reality, under the Obama administration, more people were deported and more immigrants held in detention centers than under any previous administration. The Obama administration passed DACA, which affords temporary protection to youth who immigrated to the United States as children. They must be under the age of 31, enrolled in school or the military, and have a clean criminal record in order to qualify for DACA. While we support recipients of DACA or Dreamers, it is important to note that DACA is an inadequate solution as it provides only temporary protection to those who face a permanent struggle. We support the rights of all immigrants to stay in this country regardless of age, student status, or criminal history, and to be permanently protected from deportation. Ultimately, the Democrats are a capitalist party who run on mediocre progressive politics and then neglect to follow through on any campaign promises that do not benefit the interests of the ruling class. A truly pro-immigration, pro-refugee movement would include anti-war, anti-imperialist demands, and the Democrats have not supported these types of movements in the past, as war and imperialism are key tools of capitalists in maintaining the hegemony of world dominance. Therefore, we cannot count on the Democrats to support these movements in the future. The reason, though, that Democrats can run on pro-immigration campaign rhetoric is because capitalists are not inherently anti-immigration. It actually benefits capitalists to have an unregulated, low-wage labor force at their disposal. However, they use racism and deportations as a tool to control the working class. Racism is a tool constructed under capitalism to divide the working class, deterring people from identifying with each other and recognizing the same struggle against the ruling class. Deportations are used to scare immigrants and refugee communities into hiding so that they do not feel confident enough to speak out and organize for better work and living conditions. In addition to building an anti-war, anti-imperialism movement in this country as part of our fight for immigrant rights, we must organize ourselves to fight against the continued attacks on immigrants from the right-wing regime and fight for a world without borders, the abolition of vice, and amnesty for all.
I have a cough, so that's going to happen. I apologize in advance for the recording. So it's really hard to write this. So much happens like every day. Today, on the way here, I was reading that Trump appointed a denaturalization task force, which I didn't have time to rewrite the talk, but it's horrific, and I think it speaks to that, you know, this moment we're living in. I spent, you know, most of the talk focusing on this new demand that has taken footing, the abolishing ICE, because I think it opens like a huge opportunity to rebuild this mass immigrant movement that can actually win the demands that we want. The escalating war on immigrants by the Trump regime, most recently exposed through the horrific separation of migrant parents and children, has struck a nerve and mobilized millions of people in the last few weeks. We have seen an explosion of protests ranging from vigils to occupation of ICE offices and detention centers to banner drops of the Statue of Liberty. More importantly, we have seen a sharp left turn in the movement represented in the growing calls for the abolition of ICE and the Customs and Border Patrol. The demand is quickly entering the mainstream, capturing headlines in media outlets and even reaching the vernacular of segments of the Democratic Party. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the insurgent Democratic Socialist, who won stunning primary upset in New York last week, ran on this issue. And the Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand, both considered possible 2020 presidential contenders, have also taken up the call. As NBC News recently put it, the abolition demand was confined to the fringes just months ago in a party that has historically balanced calls for better treatment of migrants with support for stronger border security and enforcement. But as an emboldened left challenges all assumptions about everything from healthcare to jobs, doing away with ICE has become the latest issue left-wing insurgents can use to differentiate themselves from the more established rivals in Democratic primaries. Well, these are exciting developments and are a clear result from movements on the ground. I think if you're here today, it's because you are at the very least skeptical that the Democrats are going to lead the charge in dismantling ICE. And history has taught us just that. They probably will not. In fact, most Democrats have kept their distance from this demand. Even Bernie Sanders, who inspired millions with his anti-establishment rhetoric, refused to join the abolition call, instead asking Congress to pass more rational immigration policies. And I think I read an article, he was talking about comprehensive immigration reform, which no one's even talking about right now. He's so 2010. And even those that have supported the demand are probably going to feel the pressure from the Democratic Party as we get closer to November, you know, with the concerns that such a bold demand is going to scare people from voting and it's going to be detrimental for Democrats. We are already also seeing attempts by the liberal media to downplay the significance of the demand by equating it to merely symbol of Democrats' opposition to Trump's immigration policies. Quote, a shorthand way to remind lawmakers and the public that Democrats don't like how the president has demonized immigrants. Yet, for many of us, the abolition of ICE and CBP is not just a slogan or a campaign trail talking point, but a practical, urgent, and necessary demand to ensure that our people can live in safety and with dignity. ICE and Border Patrol combined now are the largest federal police force with over 20,000 employees. Their budget of $6 billion is more than that of all the federal law enforcement agencies combined. The central assumption of ICE in 2018 is that any undocumented immigrant is inherently a threat. Acting Director Thomas Homan has repeatedly made clear that all undocumented residents should be afraid of his agents. Moreover, he has threatened to jail and prosecute local officials in so-called sanctuary cities that do not fully comply with ICE mandates. The agency has also clearly been targeting political opponents and activists and has worked to deport individuals for speaking to media about ICE. Today, ICE is a rogue agency. It's a rogue agency that acts unchecked, and its actions are covered up under the pretense of national security. Meanwhile, it occupies brown communities and lurks in early dusk hours behind dumpsters or around the corner of our homes, in unmarked vehicles, and plainclothes agents that disappear our loved ones, whether or not they actually pose a threat to national security. They enter communities without warrants and blatantly lie about who they are and what they seek, and there's no way to hold their lies and intrusions accountable. But if one thing was made clear by the rallies and actions in over 800 cities this past weekend is that a significant segment of the population is outraged and is ready to take action against both the sheer brutality of a Trump administration and the slow-burning but equally effective duplicity of the Democrats alike. The obvious reason for the proliferation of the abolition calls today is, of course, Trump, whose openly racist support of mass deportations has exposed ICE and CBP as the sick and inhumane agencies they always have been. Under Trump, the media has paid more attention to ICE outrages, like abducting parents as they drive their children to school, stalking courthouses to seize women looking for protection from domestic violence, and snatching a brain tumor patient right from her hospital bed. In just the first 18 months of his presidency, he has been able to push a travel ban on Middle Eastern and Arab nations. He has seen, led attacks against hard-fought programs such as DACA and TPS. And we have seen escalation of ICE raids, not just at the border, but all over the country. This past couple weeks, we've seen some of the biggest employment workplace raids in the past 10, 11 years. And some of the stories are just, I was reading one of them, the ICE agents came to the break room with donuts and offered donuts to the workers, and then went on to take 114 people. That's 114 families separated, just like that. But it would also be wrong to see that abolished ICE calls purely as a response to Trump's administration's atrocities. As Sean McElwee wrote in The Nation, quote, "The call to abolish ICE is above all a demand for the Democratic Party to begin seriously resisting an embrittled white supremacist surveillance state that it had a hand in creating." For example, it was Rahm Emanuel, when he was senior advisor to then-President Bill Clinton, that wrote that the president should work to, quote, "claim and achieve record deportations of criminal aliens." Clinton attempted just that when he decided to support the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996, which set up the legal infrastructure for mass deportations and expanded the number of crimes considered deportable. Among other things, it also introduced the Section 27G, which permitted for local enforcement to become deputized and engage in immigration enforcement functions. If for folks, this is not making news yet, but 27G is actually under Trump been expanded all over again. In Alamance County in North Carolina, where I organize, we're actually fighting for the program to come back. The sheriff is trying to bring it back. Back in 2009 to 2011, about 10% of the immigrant population was deported under that program. So it's something that we should keep an eye on. Even Barack Obama, while he made pains to distinguish between good and bad immigrants, presided over aggressive deportation tactics in his first term in order to build support for the path to citizenship that never came. Obama vowed to focus enforcement resources on, quote, "actual threats to our security, felons, not families, criminals, not children, gang members, not a mom who's working hard to provide for her kids," end quote. With this dehumanizing dichotomies, Obama didn't just overlook the fact that people convicted of felonies also have families and loved ones, or that the children, particularly children of color, all too often are treated as criminals from a very young age. He also ignored the fundamental injustice of a system in which non-citizens may be branded as criminals for the most trivial of offenses and then face expulsion from the country on this basis. Moreover, Obama helped legitimize the same narrative that Trump is using today to target all immigrants. But the humanizing narrative of good and bad immigrant is rooted in the Democrat solution to the immigration problem, known as the comprehensive immigration reform. Simply put, comprehensive immigration reform is a framework in which an eventual path to citizenship is promised to a section of undocumented immigrants in return for increased repression against other immigrants and future ones trying to enter the country. For over a decade, this framework has shaped a downward spiral for the immigrant justice movement, which progressively lowered its demands while justifying any and all crackdowns against those who fell outside its narrow terms, including the migrants who arrive at the border each summer. In the summer of 2014, for example, at the beginning of the upsurge of migration of women and unaccompanied minors from Central America, Obama made the decision to stop the longstanding practice of categorizing migrants fleeing violence and persecution as refugees, and instead sought to expedite their prosecution and removal. Hillary Clinton doubled down on this decision when she famously stated, "We have to send a clear message. Just because your child gets across the border, that doesn't mean the child gets to stay." Obama's motivation was less overtly racist than Trump's. He wanted to convince Republicans that he was serious about border control, with the hope that one day they would come to the table. Needless to say, comprehensive immigration reform did not happen. Instead, Obama billed at Trump a large machinery of deportations and detentions staffed by agents empowered to carry out a racist agenda with impunity. Thus, the calls for ICE today should be seen to represent a clear break from the trap of comprehensive immigration reform pushed by the Democratic politicians and the mainstream immigrant justice groups. But what does exactly abolishing ICE mean? As Danny Ketch wrote for Socialist Worker, abolish ICE isn't just a policy proposal. It is an assertion of the principle that no human being is illegal, and that our side won't ratify any more criminalization of immigrants in exchange for some of them gaining a chance at a reprieve. It is also a framework that for any number of standalone demands, no longer shackled to the rotten compromise of comprehensive reform. Thank you. That include cutting funding for ICE and CBP, ending the notorious bed quota that fills privately run detention centers, and a moratorium on deportations, and recognizing the right of all refugees to apply for asylum without facing imprisonment. Imagining a world without ICE shouldn't be too hard. After all, the agency has only been around for about 15 years, with its roots in the post-9/11 nationalistic panic that led to the framing of immigration as a national security issue. From these xenophobic roots, the agency has consistently expanded its technological capacities, surveillance, detention, and deportation activities. Bush created ICE, Obama expanded and sharpened its capacity for harm, and Trump gladly unleashed this weaponized behemoth against our communities. Congress continues to fund ICE despite the countless reports of its cruelty and incompetence. Ultimately, we need to make it politically impossible for Congress to continue to support immigration enforcement. We need to defund ICE, and we need legislation that dismantles the agency. That seems to, you know, scare a lot of people, but the right wing does not care when they get to defund the EPA or HUD or, you know, public school systems. So that's something to think about. There's already a movement. At least 21 Democratic congressional primary candidates have come out in favor of abolishing the agency. Over 100 members of Congress have called cutting ICE's budget this year. Groups of activists have occupied the outside of the Portland ICE office, camping outside and refusing to leave. People everywhere are pushing their local governments to refuse cooperation with ICE. Businesses are being outed and shamed by their own employees for contracting with ICE. The agency's spokespeople are turning into whistleblowers, and the heads of ICE and DHS are being followed and hounded by everyday people demanding their resignation. These are the types of actions that we need, as opposed to merely remembering in November, as liberal establishment wants us to do. For all the rightful talk of Trump's unique nastiness, nothing does more to normalize him than the idea that the trauma and pain he's inflicting every day can be neatly undone on a couple of election days in 2018 and 2020. The call to abolish ICE is an irredeemably racist and harmful institution points in a different direction for a growing left that needs to gain the confidence and vision to be at least as radical as the right we're fighting. However, not everyone supporting the abolition of ICE is calling for the eradication of the policies enacted by the agency. At least 10 Democratic members of Congress have made a nod towards the need to abolish ICE, but they largely advocate for its policies to be transferred or replaced. Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin announced last week that he plans to introduce legislation to abolish ICE, yet he stipulated that the bill will call for the transfer of necessary functions to other agencies. Similarly, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that we have to replace ICE with an updated INS-like structure that handles crimes through the same court system that we've had well over 100 years. Admittedly, even the limited call to return to 20th century policy is an important break with the post 9/11 bipartisan consensus around militarized borders and seeing immigration through the inherently racist lens of anti-terrorism. At the same time, we must recognize the country's this country's long history of mass deportations and anti-immigrant repression, and most of it has been carried through laws and systems that precede ICE and will continue to exist unless they are also abolished. Simply rebranding ICE or redistributing the work that ICE does to other agencies is not only insufficient, but would leave the incarceration and deportation apparatus virtually intact to continue to being used against our communities. For this reason, the call for the abolition of immigration enforcement agencies must be accompanied by a call for the full-scale decriminalization of immigration. We must demand that Congress stop Trump and Sessions by repealing the two laws that make migration a federal crime. The laws prohibiting unlawful entry and unlawful reentry, which I think one is punishable by 6 months and the second time up to 20 years, are the legal weapons behind Sessions' zero tolerance policy, which leads to the heartbreaking family separations by allowing the prosecution of parents. Regardless of your thoughts on the AOC election, I hope that we can all agree that we can do much better than the court system that we had for all for well over 100 years. When undocumented youth began calling for the scrap of ICE back in 2009, their demands were grounded in a massive push against the punitive and harsh policies of the US deportation apparatus, not limited to a single federal agency, and they also developed alongside protests against police and prisons. They were able to draw the connections between the movement and the struggles against mass incarceration of black folks to the movement, to their own movement, and drawn by a system that criminalized and profited from locking their communities up in cages. We must continue to draw those parallels and build a multiracial movement that fights for so that all families can remain together. We must refuse proposals that only help some immigrants, dividing our communities between those labeled worthy of humanitarian relief and those who will be left behind in a violent system of detention, incarceration, and deportation. We need solidarity that extends to all people regardless of their criminal background. This is not just a moral responsibility, but a strategic necessity. People like to quote the great socialist Eugene Debs when he famously said that, well, there's the criminal element, I am off it. In this case, his words can be taken very literally. We should defend TPS and DACA from the Trump administration. They were very, as you know, it was spoken about already, they were hard-fought battles. But also we need to be clear that they are far from ideal or even adequate solutions for immigrants and their families. Temporary programs put immigrants in a state of limbo where the state isn't forced to provide a formal citizenship process and has the power to lift protections and kick immigrants out at will. They are in line with the overall pattern of US immigration policy, which has treated immigrants and migrant labor as a reserve army to be exploited at lower pay, both to drive down wages of all workers in the interest of capital and to serve as a scapegoat for native-born workers to blame them for stealing jobs that belong to real Americans. Temporary protections are also a convenient arrangement for the Democratic Party, creating a large pool of vulnerable people constantly under the threat of losing all rights if a Republican administration is brought into power. This allows Democrats to always be seen as necessary as a necessary alternative, regardless of how badly they've sold the promises to immigrants and communities. As terrifying and exhausting as this moment is for our communities, it's also one of possibility. More people are experimenting with thinking about radical alternatives because the current reality is so terrible. As socialists, we should put forward a bold vision for the kind of solutions we want to see. This includes demanding that ICE isn't simply reform, but that its function, that of using incarceration and deportation as a way of dealing with migration, is completely eradicated. We should demand an end to all forms of immigration detention. Perhaps we can even reimagine the Border Patrol as a humanitarian force that rescues migrants rather than destroying their water supplies to hasten their deaths. Border Patrol could be staffed by emergency services, experts, and healthcare workers, not police. But why stop there? Why not demand a world without prisons and borders? A world where every single one of us can live in safety and with dignity, and we're free to move around. We cannot be afraid to be bold. We owe it to the future, for our children, our neighbors. Let's dream big and fight like we have a new world to win, because we do.
Yeah, thank you to Kristen and Juan. So last week, as part of a trip around Latin America to convince leaders in that region to do more in order to go along with the U.S.'s stance on tightening immigration enforcement and border security. Vice President Mike Pence said to a crowd in Brazil, just as we respect your borders and your sovereignty, we insist that you respect ours. Our nation needs your nations to do more. So clearly lots to unpack there. Starting with the fact that, you know, this statement, like, it wasn't just offensively historically inaccurate. If you came to the conference yesterday, you may have been at the session that talked about the CIA-backed coup in Chile, of Chile's left-wing Popular Unity government on September 11, 1973, the other September 11. Which resulted in the deaths of over 2,000 people, including that country's democratically elected socialist president, Salvador Allende, and then imprisoned or disappeared over 40,000 more. And you can have like an entire session on like, you know, American intervention in Latin America, but just to like talk about one more, you know, the U.S. As part of a project during the Cold War to destabilize left-wing governments, backed a coup in Brazil, of all places, where Pence, you know, had the audacity to say this, and that coup resulted in the Brazilian military ruling that nation for 20 years, which seems like the opposite of respecting borders and sovereignty. And if it wasn't bad enough that, you know, that he started off by that. In a comment directed at the so-called Northern Triangle nations of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, Pence added, "If you want to come to the United States, come, but come legally. Don't risk your lives or your kids' lives. Don't leave them in the hands of human traffickers or drug traffickers." And of course, Pence said this with no mention of the fact that a major obstacle for folks in that region being able to come here legally, quote unquote, is the fact that, like has been mentioned, for decades the U.S. has routinely denied asylum and refuge to Central American migrants fleeing devastation. And of course, he also made no mention of the fact that the political crisis that's forcing people to escape that reality was created by decades of U.S. interventions in Central America and Washington's support for repressive right-wing governments in those countries. And if this administration really did care about the lives of their children, then they probably would have never enacted their zero tolerance policy at the border that resulted in the separation of more than 2,000 kids from their families and placed them in these inhumane detention centers that we already talked about that we're learning are essentially concentration camps by another name. But, you know, Trump actually set this anti-immigrant tone to start the year. With his first State of the Union, he spent 90 long minutes, telling lie after opportunistic lie about his first year in power. And this was probably most apparent during his comments on immigration enforcement. He vilified undocumented communities and called for more funding for ISIS if, you know, 300% increase in funding under Obama wasn't enough. And he called members of, you know, ICE, who are a terrorist group, great people. The same compliment that he shares with that he gave to Nazis in Charlottesville. Trump also made appallingly incorrect attacks on family unification, which he referred to by the racist term chain migration, and was very quick to undermine the movements of immigrant youth known as Dreamers that we've talked about by saying that Americans are Dreamers too, which is this year's version of All Lives Matter. And while the contemporary fear-mongering of immigrants by Trump seems unique because it's an exaggerated nationalist and xenophobic tone, it's actually directly connected with the true role of borders, immigration enforcement, or capitalism, which Kristen talked about. I think it's important to go back to it a little bit, because that is, borders are actually ruling class tools of oppression and manipulation that are outside of natural and geographical boundaries, such as bodies of water or mountain ranges, are socially constructed barriers. You know, their role isn't actually to protect citizens, rather to exclude migrants at the same time that they criminalize them. And the truth is that in the U.S., the U.S. essentially operated under a basis of open borders for hundreds of years, as it was to the benefit of capital and being able to amass an industrial working class to complete the necessary demand of production. Along with the enslavement of Africans in this country, it was through the exploitation of immigrant labor that the United States was able to become the economic and political superpower that it is today. Whether it was Chinese railroad workers in the late 1800s to Southern and Eastern European workers around the turn of the following century to agricultural workers from Mexico after the First World War, and of course the hyper-exploitation of immigrants is something that we see today. It might seem like a contradiction to state that the ruling class depends on undocumented labor to thrive and stay profitable, all while we see measures of mass deportation and the terrorizing and scapegoating of immigrants, but the truth is that both of these are a symptom of the same disease, which is that capitalism needs racism to survive, and it uses anti-immigrant policies to divide and conquer, as others have talked about. It discourages these policies, or this rhetoric discourages solidarity among the working class, and it uses the threat of deportation and detention to discourage immigrant workers from organizing and bullies them into accepting poor and even dangerous working conditions. Kristen already kind of laid out some of that. Karl Marx and Frederick Engels wrote, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere." And what this means is that capital and wealth are able to flow through borders without any restriction, yet people fleeing war, poverty, persecution, or relief from climate catastrophes, which is the next sort of crisis that we're about to enter, aren't. They're told to go back. And the current narrative of security means that it's not just economic woes that immigrants are blamed for. Instead of looking at things such as the war on drugs, for-profit prisons, and other policies that criminalize human beings because of their race or because of their citizenship status, immigrants have faced the brunt of false accusations of crime in order to whip up an anti-immigrant hysteria. And as anti-racist activists, we can clearly see the intersections between immigrants' rights and the fight against mass incarceration, and how this system blames crime in the inner cities on black populations. But for-profit prisons are the reason why the racist Show Me Your Papers law in Arizona was passed in 2010, and they're also the reason why there are more black men in jail today than were enslaved during the Civil War. The same system that profits off of imprisoning black men for minor drug charges is the same system that profits off of putting babies in cages inside of these concentration camps. And like Kristen laid out, we need to be clear that the only crime that happens at the border is at the hands of the U.S. deportation and detention machine. The slogan, "No human being is illegal," is therefore not just true in the moral sense, like folks have mentioned. It is actually a central point of organizing that shows that only through solidarity that all workers, no matter what their background, no matter what their race or national origin, can challenge the status quo and thus confront the system responsible for all of the atrocities that we see in the world today. And also, as a side note, I find it pretty offensive to try to call a section of the population illegal when we're talking about land that was stolen in the first place. The idea that no human being is illegal is at the heart of why socialists stand against any instance of immigration enforcement or restriction, and contrary to the calls of that obstacle course that is comprehensive immigration reform that Juan talked about, why we demand full amnesty to all undocumented folks, no matter what country they came from, no matter how long they've lived here, no matter how much they pay in taxes, no matter how much their what their criminal record is. The movement of Dreamers has shouted, "It's all of us or none of us." And speaking of slogans, we've already talked about the call to abolish ICE and how, surprisingly, it's become a rallying cry at mass demonstrations. I say surprisingly because, just 6 months ago, that would have been something that would have been, really hard to imagine being taken up in the mainstream. And there's plenty to be excited about that slogan. There's plenty to be excited about the primary victory for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as an open socialist who calls for the abolition of ICE, because she's creating an opening for these types of conversations to happen in our workplaces, in our campuses, and in our movements. And you know, her victory has also generated a spike in interest in socialism and in revolutionary politics that we haven't really seen since the early days of the Trump administration. In fact, you know, I saw that, you know, the DSA grew by almost 2,000 members overnight after her primary victory, and you know, are at over 44,000 members last time I saw, which is actually very exciting for the prospect of the rebuilding of a mass socialist left. You know, her program, which was actually advertised by Fox News, was calling for, you know, calls for universal health care, for housing rights, for higher education for all, for full equality for women and LGBTQ folks, and many other platforms and demands that we would absolutely organize around. However, you know, as Juan read, some of the quotes coming out of not just her, but also some of the Democrats that have taken up that slogan, which those folks who have taken up that slogan, like, let's be real, like, that's actually a break from the actual line the Democratic Party has. Like, they've talked about what abolishing ICE means, the replacement of that institution with another, you know, quote-unquote, more humane structure, you know, that still gets to decide, like, who gets to stay in this country and who has to go back, you know? And what this means is that the questions about the need for a movement, you know, to remain independent from the Democratic Party is still very much a real concern. It would be naive to put our faith in the party that was responsible for secure communities, which, you know, was basically the pathway for Trump to be able to do what he does today, and of 2.5 million deportations under Obama. And you know, it's a party that has routinely done all it could to co-opt and sell out, you know, social movements throughout history. Every victory that our side has won has come from grassroots and typically radical activity. Like we talked about, you know, there was a struggle that made DACA a possibility. And, you know, DACA wasn't something that was awarded to undocumented youth by Obama. It was something that had to be won by numbers of Dreamers blocking traffic and performing other forms of civil disobedience while risking deportation that pressured and shamed Obama. And you know, like we've mentioned, DACA stops well short of being able to help everyone in the community, and it stopped well short of the demand for amnesty that we have. But it did allow relief from deportation to almost 1 million young people, and afforded them the ability to work legally and study and, you know, and drive in this country. So, you know, like, that's something that we would still, if there was a movement to defend DACA, we'd still stand along with it while raising these critiques. And, you know, speaking of betrayals by the Democrats and DACA, you know, as they were using the defense of DACA as a bargaining chip to continue expanding the militarization of the border, they had a chance to stand with Dreamers earlier this year and shut down the government against Trump. But, you know, we saw what a pathetic capitulation that was. You know, they basically just took a weekend off from Capitol Hill. You know, that failure by the Democrats, as well as the continual narrative of the good immigrant versus bad immigrant, has actually shifted sections of the movement to the left, and has led to the slogan "All of Us or None of Us" that I talked about, that has now become a staple at immigrants' rights demonstrations. And you know, we can also look at the lessons of betrayal during the height of the immigrants' rights movement and its mega marches in 2006, when it co-opted that massive movement with the slogan "Today we march, tomorrow we vote," which, like, it takes some real nerve to, like, have that slogan to a population that isn't even legally allowed to vote in the first place. But that movement actually was born out of a struggle to defeat a 2005 bill known as H.R. 4437, which then came to be known the Sensenbrenner Bill after its asshole sponsor, the Wisconsin Representative Jim Sensenbrenner. The full name of that bill was the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism, and Illegal Immigration Control Act of 05, and it seeked to increase penalties for illegal immigration and classified undocumented immigrants as aggressive felons, and also was trying to go after anyone who helped an undocumented person enter this country or remain in this country. But through this, it was estimated that over 5 million people took part in protests to strike down that racist bill. There were student walkouts and marches from beginning from March until the National Day of Action, or sorry, the National Day Without an Immigrant, which was called for on May 1st, otherwise known as International Workers' Day. And these marches were called for, organized, and attended by undocumented immigrants from all walks of life. And these were some of the largest demonstrations that this country has ever seen. Those that took part in those marches not only aimed to defeat the Sensenbrenner bill, but also took on a political character, calling for amnesty for all 11 million undocumented, which, like we said, it's a demand that we still continue to push forward today in all our publications. Reports from NBC News stated that more than a million, mostly Hispanic immigrants and their supporters, skipped work and took to the streets, flexing their economic muscle in a nationwide boycott that succeeded in slowing or shutting down many farms, factories, markets, and restaurants. But to quote socialist worker, May 1st, 2006 wasn't a boycott. It was a general strike. One well-photographed placard held by a protester said, "The sleeping giant wasn't sleeping. We were working." So these incredible marches also showed the immense power that immigrants hold as a social class, and the lessons that we can win when we fight back by withholding our labor. The spirit of those incredible marches 12 years ago actually can be traced back to the original International Workers' Day, the original May Day, which had its home here in Chicago some 120 years ago. It was like through the movement that made the 8-hour workday, weekends, and the minimum wage possible, which was also on the effort and the strength of an immigrant population. It was German and Polish immigrants in Chicago that were the backbone of that movement. And I don't have time to get into what happened then, but that story of the victory also like transformed revolutionaries and labor militants and helped create radical labor unions such as the Industrial Workers of the World, who were vital in organizing one of the largest strikes in U.S. history in the 1912 textile strike in Lawrence, Mass. The Bread and Roses strike. Over 10,000 workers from all walks of life led one of the fiercest labor battles in history, and so the workers in Lawrence were made up of at least 25 different nationalities and spoke at least 45 different languages, but in reality they showed that solidarity is the universal language of the working class. We can revive that working class history, that history of working class fight back, by continuing to make connections between immigrants' justice groups, labor unions, community organizations, and a strong left dedicated to fight all instances of oppression. We can make a loud call to stop deportations, shut down detention centers, strike down the travel bans, and cease the terrorizing of immigrants, immigrant communities by abolishing ICE. How much time do I have? Okay, so I'm gonna start wrapping up now, but I'm gonna have to cut some stuff. Okay, so there are many examples today of how community groups and labor unions can help halt Trump's deportation and detention machine. There have been the encampments and occupations of ICE buildings that have temporarily shut down facilities in Portland for over a week now, and we've also seen actions take place in San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, New York, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and hopefully there's many more to come. There's the way in which rapid response networks have been a crucial organizing vehicle in which hundreds have turned out to confront raids and arrests of undocumented folks in our communities. I know at Labor Notes this year there was panels in which members of unions talked about their experiences in these rapid response networks, into preventing raids in our workplaces. And if folks have been active in these networks, they should feel free to report on them, because we don't really have a lot of time to get into that. Masses turned out to a protest at LaGuardia in New York upon learning that there were children who had been separated from their parents in a flight from Texas. And these fast response protests were reminiscent of the airport protests last year, in which thousands turned out across the country to protest the racist Muslim travel ban. And of course, the Supreme Court recently approved the ban, showing the direct connections that American foreign policy and imperialism is responsible for the refugee crisis in the Middle East and in Latin America. And just today, I saw that activists from Chicago, including comrades from the DSA, mobilized for a demonstration in Gary, Indiana, to the airport where deportation flights fly out of. And actually, I haven't seen a full report back yet, but it sounds like they were successful in canceling those flights. rights. So, you know, we definitely need more actions like that. Speaking of workplace organizing, there's the cases like the Teamsters in New York, in which dozens of locals declared voted to declare a sanctuary union. And in a socialist worker article written by a socialist in the union, he described how, as a sanctuary union, the Teamsters have vowed not to cooperate with federal immigration agents in attempting to detain or deport members. You know, we should definitely talk about like what the question of fighting for sanctuary space is, but I think that's definitely a good starting point of what we mean by sanctuary. Amazon workers recently wrote a letter to the company's CEO that stated that they are refusing to build technology for ICE and law enforcement. They cited Trump's zero tolerance policy in comparison to Hitler and demanded that as workers they have a choice in what they produce and how it's used. And similarly, United and American Airlines employees recently released statements declaring how they refuse to operate flights that are transporting migrant children who are separated from their families. The massive marches that we've talked about in the last weekend against family separation, you know, were called by liberal and NGO groups and had some mixed politics, but definitely showed a real opening to the politics needed to actually abolish ICE. Unions such as National Nurses United, which we know has been one of the most progressive unions, calling for, you know, a program to tax the rich and to bring universal health care, mobilized members to come out to those marches. Here in Chicago, the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, called on its members to join a contingent of education justice activists. So there, you know, there's this workplace organizing is still happening today. So within the immigrant justice movement, we have seen glimpses of the type of infrastructure needed to erase inequality and oppression, to permanently end war and occupation, to build a reality in which the inhumanity of deportations and mass detentions can cease to exist. So to reappropriate a line from our enemies, the current society that we live in is a shithole. But there is an alternative to it. So if you haven't yet, join the socialists and help us build an alternative, because that is a world without borders. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.